And you can obviously tell when you compare it to a normal brain that there is some sort of inflammation. And so then it requires that you do a differential diagnosis. Well, what are the common causes of brain inflammation? So based on your not only imaging, but your physical examination and history taking, you can come up with a great differential diagnosis. And abnormal toxic scans with scalloping, they could be caused by all toxins from mold to Lyme, co-infections. But when we're talking about the Lyme patients themselves, it's typically those that are associated with those disease, Lyme disease, neurological Lyme disease presentation.
And
So
then,
that's how you can tell. You can't really look at a scan and say, hey, that's a Lyme scan. You'll say that's a toxic scan.
Right. Okay. And then do you see changes in SPECT scans several months after treatment?
Yes, you can actually see decreased activity in certain areas of the brain, specifically the basal ganglia, which is that area that's responsible for, excitement, executive functioning, and also the frontal area, which gives us that executive functioning, those decision-making abilities. So you'll see those changes. And another change you might note is when there's a lot of activity in the brain. And I've seen those changes when patients are having what you call a die-off reaction, a Herxheimer reaction, whereby the underlying infection is being treated, but at the same time, they're having a toxic reaction to the treatment of those organisms. And that was what causes a lot of blood flow, a lot of activity. And you can really compare both a pretreated brain scan with someone who's having that toxic reaction versus someone who is having worse function of the brain. But you always hope that it improves. And that's another thing you can do. I've looked at SPECT studies that are look at most imaging for tick-borne infections, and you will definitely see changes because the first pattern, it may be scalloping, toxic appearing, and then afterwards, we'll see more of a calm, symmetric brain activity, which I think is great when you have that before and after.
Yeah. How does brain imaging help patients and their families understand the illness that they're experiencing?
So it gives them not only validation, but support. So for example, chronic Lyme, neurological Lyme, patients may present with neurological conditions, may that be Alzheimer's or dementia presentations, psychiatric presentations, anxiety, depression, and even psychosis in some cases when you have that chronic Lyme disease. And a lot of my patients get dismissed by traditional medicine and even by their family members. They're diagnosed as just a psychiatric patient or, malingering or, all these different diagnoses that you provide to patients when you don't know the root cause of their illness. So when you're looking at SPECT scanning and you see these abnormalities, you see this area called the basal ganglia, which blends feeling and movement, controls the body, involved with motivation, and when it's hyperactive can cause symptoms in keeping with that fight or flight response because the deep limbic system kind of sets that emotional tone. So they're like, wait a minute, there's something organic here. And like I said, it makes parents and patients and family members feel more supported and they realize, wait, it's in my head. but it's not all in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So, and especially when you compare those SPECT scans of patients who have Lyme disease to a healthy, active brain scan. And it's like miraculous, like the support that changes overnight.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, you mentioned the deep limbic system. What's the relationship between the deep limbic system, mast cells, and histamines?
So as I alluded to earlier, the deep limbic system is that area of the brain that integrates gait sensory information, sets your emotional tone, changes your memories, your sense of smell. It also is that area that activates the autonomic nervous system, and patients can be in that hyperactive fight or flight response. However, mast cells are found there. So mast cells are cells that produce histamine. And what we know and understand is when you start to have this mast cell activation, the patient releases histamine and over 50 other different chemicals. And this person might present with anxiety, insomnia, multiple chemical sensitivity. They might present to your office with changes in blood pressure from lying to standing, which is something we call autonomic dysfunction, and allergies and sensitivities. And you're like, wait a minute, that's caused by a mast cell activation. And when you look at the brain scans as a physician, it's so rewarding because you not only understand the physiology of that disease complex, but you have anatomy and that change in blood flow and activity that supports it.
Now, I've heard you mention the term cortisol steal. What is that? Or limbic steal phenomena?
Oh, yes. That's one of my favorite topics to discuss with patients. Because when your body is producing cortisol, which is your stress hormone, it requires a lot of your energy and your focus because the body's like, yes, we're stressing that person out. We're producing more stress hormone. And over time, you'll start hearing people complain of this kind of wired but tired response because that stress hormone, the cortisol, becomes too high. And if your body is only focusing on stress, it has the inability to focus on healing. So what will happen is that you'll have so much of this stress hormone being produced that leads to organs like the adrenals being impacted that your body loses steam. And then it can't function on things like healing other systems like the thyroid or regulating your menstrual or sex hormone production. It won't have any energy to help you with your cognition because all your body is saying is, yes, let us stress out. So that's kind of what we call that cortisol steal complex.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that explanation. What is the Cunningham panel and how do you use it to test and monitor patients?
So the Cunningham panel, and I'm glad you brought this question up because it's one of my favorite tests to use when I'm treating Lyme disease. I'm sorry, PANDAS, which is called Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorder Associated with Strep Throat. And you can also have the same panel used to diagnose people who have just pediatric autoimmune, meaning your immune system is attacking itself, neuropsychiatric syndromes associated with numerous other bacteria. That's where chronic Lyme disease, co-infections, viruses, all of those things that can make your brain so inflamed that you begin to create what we call antibodies that attack your brain cells. So when you have this panel, you are able to determine, because they've done such a brilliant job of determining which antibodies can be associated with mood or dopamine problems, which antibodies can be associated with OCD. And also, they have this one marker called the CAM kinase 2. And that marker is the one that, when you see abnormal, usually indicates that there is some sort of a current active infection that's triggering your patient's symptoms. And it's fascinating because I'll have a lot of patients where I find I'm treating them that might have neuropsychiatric symptoms, and I'm treating them. I might see things like mood swings, movement disorders, tics, obsession and compulsion, brain fog. And what the Cunningham panel does is it determines and it will tell you, well, what autoantibody does this person have? And then when you get involved into the CAM autoantibody, that's when you see that present, it's like, aha, this person is having that sympathetic nervous system fight or flight behavior associated with immune modulation of some kind by infections. We first, like I said earlier, thought just of strep, but now we know they can be associated with numerous other infections as well. And that's when I use that, when I'm not only explaining to patients that, look, your psychiatric symptoms, your cognitive impairment may be due to an autoimmune process. And so that's when we get those results. The higher the CAM is, that indicates active infection. And you can do pre and post Cunningham panels. So pre meaning before treatment, post meaning after treatment, with the hope that those autoantibodies that have been created after treatment are improved. So I love it. I love that test.
Oh, thank you. Now, in our podcast, we've learned from some scientists about astrocytes and the glial lymphatic system and their role in clearing toxins from the brain. In your practice, what have you found most useful in clearing toxins from the brain?
I've seen quite a few things. So as it relates to just treatment options, I find myself using more IV detoxification methods that are evidence-based. May that be glutathione, which is what we call a free radical scavenger. And I explain it to patients as something that goes around the body like Pac-Man and clears all those toxins by helping the liver to achieve that goal. You can also use B vitamins that allow the body to help clear toxins. And then I've found that you can do those things manually as well by using something called craniocervical manipulation. So you can have craniocervical syndrome due to complications from chronic infections, head trauma, mold and mold toxicity, and post-concussion syndrome. And what it leads to is misalignment of this critical junction at the cranial skull base and what you call a cervical axis, which is, bones in your neck and other neck, cervical vertebrae. And as a result, it prevents that body's lymphatic function and can affect your cerebral blood flow, the CSF.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
So when patients have that manipulation, and it's called atlas orthogonal manipulation, it fixed that area and allows for the patients, the brain to be able to release those toxins better. So that's a fascinating way and something I found very, very helpful with my patients.
Wow. Have you seen changes in patients in their SPECT scans, patients who've participated in the dynamic neural retraining system?
Oh, of course. So as I alluded to earlier, not only the mast cells are impacted by the limbic system because that's where they reside, but patients who have those neurological manifestations of Lyme disease also have more activity, more brain flow, more function in that limbic system. So when patients go through programs like DNRS, which is one of their major goals, is to calm that limbic system, calm that fight or flight response, which is one of the ways it improves mast cell activity. Patients who have cardiovascular impact, like what I mentioned earlier, that change in blood pressure from lying to standing called autonomic dysfunction, and just multiple chemical sensitivities and anxiety. Because it calms that limbic system activity down. And so I find a lot of patients, first I'll get their brain scan, and it'll look toxic. They'll have increased activity in the basal ganglia and the limbic, deep limbic system. And then after they do those programs, it calms down and you see less activity.
Fascinating. What is toxoplasma? Are you seeing that in your patients?
So toxoplasma is the country, this is even by the Center for Disease Control. It's an infection that's caused by a single cell parasite called Toxoplasma gondii. And it's found all around the world. And what I find is a lot of doctors don't screen for it. But this parasite can persist for long, very long periods of time in your body. Often people that are affected by it are fine. They have very few symptoms because their immune system is strong. And that holds true for a lot of common chronic conditions. Your immune cells, your immune system is strong, so you're fine. However, when your immune system is attacked or compromised, toxoplasma infection can cause serious health problems. It's one of the infections that pregnant women are screened for. Patients who have compromised immunity are screened for. And it can also be found not only from pigs, are a very, very common vector, sources like cat litter boxes that can transmit toxoplasma. And then we have other sources that have shown that it can be tick-borne as well. So we know it's foodborne, poor hygiene, cat litter boxes, contaminated soil, and also ticks. So one of the many problems with toxoplasma is its impact on the central nervous system. So studies have shown that patients who have this parasite also suffer from things like schizophrenia or psychoses. And when you treat a patient for the parasite, surprisingly enough, those neurological symptoms also improve. So it's something that I think all Lyme patients or doctors should be screening for. If you can test for chronic toxoplasma, which is immunoglobulin G, or you can look for the importance of newer, more active toxoplasma, immunoglobulin M, IgG and IgM. And the funny thing is, as we were trained in school, IgG, oh, that's chronic. That's most likely inactive, but not in toxo, just like with most tick-borne vectors. The literature shows that this parasite, even if you only have immunoglobulin that's positive IgG, the more chronic one, it's still active. It can still persist, and patients still need to be treated. And what I find fascinating is that for my patients who have toxoplasma antibodies, you can track it. They go down as a person's getting better. They go up as a patient's getting worse. So that's one of the few diseases that we have, infectious diseases that we have, that we can monitor. And that those values typically correlate with their clinical presentation.
Thank you for that. Is there any emerging research that you're excited about?
Oh, I'm always excited about research. But some of the more recent papers that have like blown my mind are papers out of a physician, Dr. Zhang. He wrote a paper on persistent Lyme disease, showing that Borrelia burgdorferi has the ability to become a persistent organism even after treatment, which I thought, finally, we have a paper that shows that. And then we have others that are more integrative. So the one that completely changed how I treated a tick-borne infection called Bartonella, which is a tick-borne organism associated most of the time with cognitive impairment and neurological imbalances, is something called methylene blue. And methylene blue, it's wonderful because all it is a dye. You can get it in a liposomal form. They traditionally used to use it for chronic urinary infection. But it's also really works really well with antimicrobials such as Zithromax, rifampin, ciprofloxacin, and clotrimazole at treating persistent Bartonella. And I find great, great results, you know, after I read that paper, because in Lyme, we don't know everything, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
We're always expanding our fund of knowledge. I'm like, okay, this will work for those tougher cases. And it's been miraculous. And I don't use that term lightly with the positive outcomes that I've seen among my patient populations who have persistent Bartonella. I've also found it helpful with my patients who suffer from that disorder we mentioned earlier, which is pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with strep or other infections. It's promising because of its ability to treat chronic stationary phase Lyme disease and Bartonella. And we know that both of those organisms can contribute to PANS and PANDA. So it blows my mind. So those papers, and then there were other papers published last year. And I'm sorry, I forget the author. I'm sorry. But they showed that plant-based herbals like cryptolepis and Japanese knotweed were more superior than antibiotics at the treatment of chronic Borrelia. And that also blew me away. I said, oh, wait, okay, this is a game changer. And then ILADS, we had a paper where we published on chronic Lyme disease and proving that there is that myth out there that, oh yeah, a short course of treatment is sufficient. But the paper referred to those persisters, those patients who after treatment are still symptomatic. And it provided the benefit or the explanation of why persistent treatment can be necessary in some of those more challenging patients. So I know that there is more research in all of those different areas. I know there's more research coming out about persisters of Borrelia. So I'm really excited about where we will be in 10 years as it relates to the evidence-based approach at the treatment of these chronic conditions.
Oh, most definitely. Well, I really want to thank you, Dr. Cornish, for sharing your time and your expertise with us today. And mostly, I want to thank you for being a doctor who thinks outside of the box and stepping into this area of learning.
Oh, things you can find out when you're searching for furniture on Craigslist. Oh, well, thank you for this opportunity. For your listeners, I do encourage doctors, chiropractors, nurse practitioners, all of the above, all of the health practitioners to really consider some of these chronic infections on your differential diagnosis when you're treating a patient who has all these nebulous symptoms and they present to your office. Don't forget about chronic infections on your differential diagnosis.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Cornish, and have fun at the ILADS conference in Florida this year.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for this opportunity.
And that's a wrap on another fabulous interview. I loved learning about how SPECT scans show improvement after treatment and damage is not permanent. Remember, everyone, stay safe in the outdoors.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Giant sequoia trees can grow hundreds of feet tall and live for thousands of years in secluded groves along California's Sierra Nevada mountains.
When you walk into a giant sequoia grove, it's really awe-inspiring.
That's Ben Blum of the nonprofit Save the Redwoods League. He says sequoias evolved to thrive in wildfire-prone areas, but now some wildfires are so intense that they can kill even these massive trees. That's because over the past century, land managers have worked to prevent forest fires. So over time, leaves and branches have piled up into a powder keg of burnable material. Add to that, global warming.
It kind of creates a perfect storm.
Since 2020, extreme fires have killed more than 10% of California's mature giant sequoias. So Blum's organization is part of a coalition that's working to protect the remaining trees. To prevent fires from growing too strong, they're pulling flammable fallen leaves and branches out of sequoia groves. And they're planting more young sequoias and other native trees to give these ancient forests a lifeline to the future.
We're hoping that the work that we're doing will ensure that future generations also have that opportunity to visit these places and have that feeling of awe and inspiration.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.